I am Plata on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Last year, the World Health Organization designated this year, 2020, as the International Year of the Nurse and Midwife. It's fitting we acknowledge the nurse who, in 1965, published a memoir of her time in the Yukon and northern British Columbia in the late 1940s and early 1950s. Then it was called No Man Stands Alone. Last fall, her grandniece, the author Laurel Diedrich Main, was instrumental in the reissue of the book under its new, more appropriate title, When Days Are Long, Nurse in the North. Ms. Diedrich Main joins me now to talk about her great aunt and the memorable experience Miss Wilson had as a nurse covering 518,000 square kilometers, responsible for the health of 3,000 indigenous peoples. She was more than just a nurse, more than a healthcare provider. She became a friend and an advocate. It's a fascinating relationship she had with the people of the North. She wasn't condescending or patronizing. She was the best example of what a nurse should be, with care at the fore. I'll get Laurel to reflect on the epidemics that Amy Wilson saw firsthand and treated. It is timely as we live in the COVID-19 era where the coronavirus is as mysterious as it is dangerous. The original book in 1965 was published by Grace Publishing, long out of business. I'll ask Laurel about its new edition from Caitlin Press. Laurel Diedrich Main was first on the show in 2015 when her debut novel, Awake for the Dreamland, was published. It went on to win the Alberta Reader's Choice Award and the Whistler Independent Book Award and was a bestseller in Edmonton for 80 weeks, where she joined me from last week. Visit ldmbooks.ca for more information. Please welcome back to the Plant on the Line program, Laurel Diedrich Main. Ms. Diedrich Main, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What was the impetus to bringing the book back? Because I understand the original publisher, that's long out of business, isn't it?
It's long out of business. That was Gray's Publishing, and actually this book put Gray's Publishing on the map. It was a tiny little fledgling BC Press, and then this book, which came out in 1965 originally, was a huge bestseller, selling 1,000 copies a month in Canada, was published in the UK and the US, at a time when I think people had a real thirst for women adventuring stories. They had a thirst for knowledge about northern Canada. She was pioneering as an author, but also certainly as a nurse.
And the book was originally called No Man Stands Alone, is that right?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, that title, I've gone back and forth feeling like, oh, I kind of miss the old title. And then I look at, now it's called When Days Are Long, and I go, oh, my goodness, if ever there was a time when we were experiencing long days, it's now. And I could not have predicted that when we decided on the title change. It just kind of gives me goosebumps to think about that now. With the original title, No Man Stands Alone, the real reason behind that was how in the North, now as well, but then certainly nobody could survive without the help of others. And so it was a valuable title then as No Man Stands Alone, but it's also an equally valuable title now as When Days Are Long.
Indeed. When the book opens, she's recounting stories about, I'm trying to remember now, was it diphtheria?
Yeah, it was a diphtheria outbreak.
Yeah. The chapter's called Epidemic, and when one reads it nowadays, it's emphasis on terribly, terribly relevant, isn't it?
I'm sad to say, yes, it is terribly relevant, and and in the North, but as you know, we're finding this worldwide, of course, as we watch the news hourly and daily.
Yeah.
An epidemic can turn into a pandemic. That's what we're in the middle of right now. When Amy was nursing in the North, that epidemic threatened to wipe out an entire Indigenous community. And, you know, God help us, we're not going to see entire communities wiped out at this time. But, yeah, it is timely beyond measure, beyond anything we could have predicted when we sought to bring this book out in the fall.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about the upbringing for Amy Wilson, speaking of epidemics, scarlet fever at the early part of the 20th century, that touched her life, didn't it?
It did. So she, her entire family was ill with scarlet fever, and she had lost her mother when she was three. They were as a family of seven. It was actually my grandmother who ended up raising the younger siblings. But they were, in a way, protected somewhat because they were on a farm. They could, and they were a large family. So as different individuals in the family became sick, those that were getting better could take care of the ones who were sick. And so even as a tiny child, when another sibling was sick, or an older one or a younger one, Amy was called upon to do her share and haul water up from the creek and, help nurse that person back to health. It did affect everybody in the family differently, and I think this is kind of ironic in Amy's case, because what was damaged was her heart, and you would never know it by the kinds of physical endurances she had to undertake in her life as a nurse in the North. She wasn't having patients come to her, you know, she was out there physically blazing a trail by snowshoe or riding horseback all night to get to a camp, that kind of thing, and she never let anybody know that she had a weak heart. So it's kind of interesting.
So it seems that a career in nursing was inevitable for her.
I think so. There's a little family story. She did try 1 year as teacher training, and she just hated it. And in the family, they all supported each other getting their education as well.
Yeah.
And she went back to her siblings and said, I really don't want to be a teacher. I want to be a nurse. And so they all pooled their resources and helped Amy through nursing school. And that is where she really found her place. She just really cared for people, and she was a terrific nurse.
So this book covers her time in the Yukon from, I guess it's 49 to 51, is that right?
Maybe, I can't even remember if it was 51 or 53 that it wraps up.
Yeah.
She stayed in the North until 1958, but more in northern BC.
I see.
So yeah, the book just covers the early part of her northern nursing career. And I will maybe add this now. You were probably going to ask it on your list of things, but she was strictly a nurse for the Indigenous people. So she always worked in sort of those more underserved populations. She wasn't like a hospital starchy white uniformed nurse.
Where they all wore hats in the day, right?
Yes, crisp little hats with a black band and a little pin on them and little white stockings and white shoes. No, she was in several layers of, trousers and furs and an Air Force down jacket and, whatever was required, because often she was out in temperatures as low as like minus 58 Fahrenheit. This is back in the days of Fahrenheit.
I'd assume a posting up there was not necessarily attractive to someone coming out of nursing school. So how did Amy Wilson, how did she end up there?
Well, you know, she finished nursing school at the kind of peak of the Depression, so she would take a job anywhere she could get it. And she began her career in northern Alberta. There was, in the Peace River country, another sort of... again, a public health position that opened up, and that's where she really began to find that she loved. She was, and I've heard this sort of mythology around the call of the North, the call of the wild, and I think she was called to that region. It wasn't like it was some kind of punishment for her. She was drawn there, and that's where she really felt at home.
She describes very vividly some of these conditions up north, that are less ideal for the practice of medicine, but she doesn't complain about them. She's frank. She describes him very well as a writer. But there's not a sense of complaint in terms of the work she has to do or the people that she has to interact with.
No, and I find that quite interesting because, and I guess it sort of speaks to that true nature of humanity, which again, we're also finding that now, but there are the half cup or the half full cup people and the half empty cup people. And I think she always believed in the goodness of her fellow men. She always believed that for every obstacle, there was an opportunity or a way around it. You know, when she was traveling into the far north with, I think it was a Chev, but when things broke down, you know, that she would get and shovel her way out or keep the gas line from freezing by inserting ether into the gas line. I mean, she always believed and acted as if things were going to be okay. And I think that kind of optimism and sheer will also served her well as a nurse when conditions to some other people might look impossible to overcome.
And
she would look at it as an opportunity. Yeah. No, we'll get there.
Yeah, it's also instructive for us, isn't it, today?
It's very instructive for us. Oh, I'm sorry, we're going to hear my clock chiming in the background. It's instructive because on two levels. One, on how we really can make the most of a bad situation,
uh-huh.
How there's always, like we were just talking about, sort of ways to try to achieve success in dire circumstances. But I think more importantly is how we treat our fellow human beings, how we value and respect our differences, how we believe that we can get along, coexist, mutually support. And so that was a really overriding quality to her as a person, as a writer, as a nurse. All aspects of her humanity were founded in that kind of mutual respect.
And that's at the heart of the book when she writes about her work with the indigenous. I found it particularly insightful, her observations, obviously. It is a different time in a way, but at the same time, a lot of the problems that the indigenous, that natives face in this country, it almost reads contemporary, doesn't it?
It does. You know, and of course you will have noticed from having read through it on the weekend, there's language that she uses, and then we had a real discussion around, Caitlin Press published
right.
this book, and we had quite a conversation about the language and decided not to change it. In the 40s, 50s, 60s, people referred to Indigenous people as Indians. We didn't change any part of the book other than writing a new foreword and introduction. So the text of the book is Amy's original, and so she uses that word, but not in a disparaging way at all, like we might consider it like a discriminatory word today. But so she uses the word Indian. But having said that, Joe, I just lost the track. I just went off the track here. What was the question?
Well,
how it is contemporary.
How she viewed the indigenous was interesting, and because it's instructive in a way as to how the relationship should be.
Yes, and without it being preachy, you know, we have a lot of
or condescending or looking down.
Or condescending,
know what I mean?
Yeah. You know, she, and again, that just speaks to her almost childlike. Even though she was very smart and mature and all of that, she was in her 40s when she was up there. But she had almost a childlike zest for life and interest in humanity. So she never judged the methods of original medicine, or we call yeah. them call it traditional medicine, but really, you know, the indigenous people have survived for millennia. So I like the term original medicine, and she was fascinated by it. And I have in my own possession, because I have all of her material from all of her life, a little envelope that I think her friend old Lucy gave her with a particular root in it, and how, you know, you boil that root in water and what that's for. And she took copious notes, some of which kind of end up in the book, yeah. where she talks about the original medicines, and she never once thought that they had no value or that what she was offering was better. She was adding what was required because of the introduction of our sort of outside or white diseases into the region.
Uh-huh.
But she had great interest and value and curiosity for what was working for them for millennia. And it's that kind of respect that we can really draw from. You know, it's like nothing fancy. This is just plain, time-honored traditions of what worked medicinally. And so we can really take a page from her book.
It's a very practical approach to medicine, because what works always works. And what's new and in terms of, say, development and science or medicine, you know, it adds to it, and you don't really throw anything that's good out, and you get that sense from her.
Yeah, you don't throw anything good out, and you also, you know, the table really gets turned, because she is the foreigner in that territory,
yeah.
So she had to meet people where they were, and, you know, they were quite rightfully suspicious of the medicine that she was offering, and that suspicion would gradually turn over to a curiosity and acceptance. And that's because every time she would go into a camp or a region or a community, she would meet up with the medicine person and the chief and get to know them before she started imparting her great white wisdom upon them. You know, like it was always a shared experience. And
so being up there, she obviously gets to know the people. It's a vast terrain, isn't it? I mean,
200,000 square miles was her district.
Yeah, the conditions, as I mentioned earlier, not always ideal.
No.
A lot of ground to cover, literally. She had a lot to say about the lot of natives in this country. And even when she resigns, she is compelled to go public about the reasons why.
Yes, and you know, I'll tell you here, Joe, she always had intended to write a second book, which I think was not going to have quite the same charm as the first book, because over time she became increasingly disillusioned by the government, which was her employer. You know, she worked for Department of Indian Affairs, at their lack of support, their lack of understanding. I mean, they give her this job as the public health nurse for the Yukon Territory in northern BC, that 200,000 square miles I was telling you about.
Yeah.
But then they're not giving her the resources that she needs.
Mm-hmm.
There's correspondence where basically her employers are saying, you know, oh, do what you can, but these people don't really matter, and you don't have to do too much. And she, I think her heart, or she became very disheartened, and that's why I said it's kind of ironic that she, you know, she had this weakened heart that she never told anybody about.
Mm-hmm.
But over time, her loss of faith in her government, in her employer, really began to wear on her, and she was gathering material and documenting stuff so she could write a second book, which never happened. Be that as it may, in 1958, just as she had completely given up, and she went to the press and called out the government for their lack of support for Indigenous people, and really basically said, I see no hope. I see no hope for the Indigenous people until the government begins to recognize that these are not just, you know, numbers on a paper, but real people with real needs and real lives and real value. And I haven't had time to go to Ottawa and go through the archives there, but there's a little dispute around whether she actually resigned or was asked to resign. Mm. Is it resigned or resigned in quotations? But
right.
Anyway, that was the end of her career in the North, and that's when she settled down to start really writing this first book. I think she was quite brokenhearted, and actually she died just weeks after the book came out.
Yeah. As I was reading the book, I really read the book in the fall and then reread parts of it just before we chatted a few days ago. What struck me was her gift at communicating. The book is clear. It's highly readable. Did she always want to write? Like, even as a kid, was that something that she did?
Only insofar as writing and letter writing and so on is a thing that has just been passed through our family generation to generation. Even when, you know, when her mother died when she was so young, her father ensured that all of the kids were well educated and that they, you know, corresponded with other relatives. So I think she was just used to documenting her life. And of course, she had to file all these reports to Department of Indian Affairs monthly, on a monthly basis. But she also wrote a lot of poetry, and I have a binder full of letters that she wrote back to our family, which kind of corroborate everything that's in the book. So
yeah.
She was always processing her experiences that way, in a written way. And yet there's nothing, and I say that nothing like, intentionally, nothing fancy about any of her writing, and that's what I also really love about the book. It's accessibility to a really wide audience. That even you know, there were some early reviews that came out in 1965 suggesting that this book would be good for students, you know, sort of middle school age students, and it's true, you know. The age range of people that could tap into the book is very, very broad, because it's not, it's not complicated. It's pretty harrowing sometimes.
Yeah,
it's delivered with such simplicity, and then you go, it was how cold, or she walked how far, and
there's a moment early in the book where I guess a person was choking, and their friend decides to help out.
yes, with the handiest tool they had, which was a pair of pliers. This was right during her first encounter with the diphtheria epidemic. I think it was in the very first tent that she went to. Maybe it was the second one. But where a choking person's friend took those, you know, what diphtheria does, you know, with we're talking about COVID these days, and that's like deep in the lungs. Diphtheria forms a membrane over the throat. It's like a thick gray membrane. It's visible if the mouth is open. You can see that membrane. And this fellow's friend just thought, okay, that's what the trouble is. I'm going to go in there and try and get it out, and grabbed a pair of pliers and ripped it out.
Right.
Probably saved his life. It's a wonder he didn't die of infection.
Right, right.
It's amazing, eh?
Yeah. The Amy Wilson that is in this book, When Days Are Long, and the one that's in the letters to the family, is that the same person?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's no... I was going to say doubt, but you know, you're probably a little more unguarded with your family than you say are for a larger audience when you're writing a book. Her thoughts, her feelings about her time there, they're pretty much the same, are they?
What a great question. They are very much the same, which is kind of fascinating. She didn't sugarcoat things in her book, and she didn't sugarcoat things to her family, but she also didn't succumb to any self-pity. Even her letters to the family she doesn't whine about her despair with the government in those letters. You know, she doesn't really complain ever. Yeah, and I think she internalized that.
And it goes the other way, too, because, I mean, you know, there's a moment in the book where she writes about not having the time to write back to her family and wanting to because they're naturally worried about her.
Yeah.
And so you may want to, say, cover that up in a letter to your family if you're not feeling great at that moment, right?
You know. Yeah. You know, I remember, Joseph, we had a conversation about my last book when we were talking about letter writing during the Second World War and how often the soldiers would paint quite a, oh, what a lovely war we're having picture for their parents back home so as not to cause worry. And, you know, when Amy was writing, that Alaska Highway had only just been built. It was really in that very early period after the war. So I don't know if it's indicative of the era, but where people didn't generally write any kind of self-indulgent boo-hoo kind of correspondence. It was, more to shelter their families from worrying about them.
Yeah. The you mentioned a moment ago about her plans to write another book. Did you find in her papers notes, say, or a sense of where that book was headed?
That, yes, absolutely, because it took me a couple of years to do this, to get everything arranged chronologically, and what I noticed in the next batch of papers, the next batch of letters, because I also have all of her reports to the Department of Indian Affairs, as well as the correspondence to family, as well as all the clippings that came out with the release of this book.
Yeah.
And where she was talking about planning to write that second book and how it was going to, shine a little more broader light, I guess would be the way to say it, on the deteriorating conditions.
Uh-huh.
So it wasn't going to be as cheerful. It's different than this, you know. I was contemplating kind of putting that material together and writing that second book myself, and have since decided not to. It will, you know, eventually end up in an archive, and I hope that some future writer, ideally an Indigenous writer, would take that on.
Uh-huh.
At this point in time, I don't think we need another white woman's voice writing about a time and an area where it could maybe be differently or better expressed by a different writer at a different time. Anyhow, all that material will be there waiting for some future person, but it would be interesting because I think she was going to lead up to what led her to ultimately go to the press.
Right.
What were some of those situations? And I had, in the introduction to the book that I've written, I think I mentioned one of those. I've got the book on my lap here. For example, there was an elderly, disabled Indigenous woman who Amy came upon at her cabin in the autumn, and this woman is hauling on her hands and knees from the edge of the woods to her cabin, armloads of sticks, trying to get wood stored for the winter. And Amy is writing a letter to Department of Indian Affairs begging for a pension for this woman. Mm. And, you know, there's more of that kind of thing where she's really shining a very, very intimate lens on the very personal plight of particular people. And then the correspondent saying, if this person doesn't deserve a pension, I don't know who does. Like, yeah. Come on, come yeah. on, come on. And there's never anything coming back.
Yeah.
So that's how that second book would have unfolded.
And incredible foresight on her part that as a nurse, you know, I mean, you're providing care, cure even for the moment, but thinking ahead long after she's not there anymore, right?
Foresight, do you mean in terms of?
Yeah, the amount of care or the sort of care that a nurse provides doesn't end when they leave and go on to other work.
Right.
You know,
right.
and again, another instructive moment for us, the reader, 60 years later, more, right?
60 years later. Like, how is it possible, Joe, that 60 years later, you could still go into communities in the North where there isn't clean drinking water?
Right.
How is it that 60 years later, we still have, you know, conditions that are not much different than what Amy encountered and was calling out about, you know, it doesn't speak well for us, I'm afraid.
No.
And you know, what I would hope is, you know, and this is in the spirit of Amy, I look at this pandemic now and I go, okay, in this horrible situation, surely there is time to contemplate what opportunity exists here to make things better.
Yeah.
It's what she would have wished. I mean, as far as just nursing is concerned, she really wanted to see more Indigenous nurses. She understood that in these regions, it made sense, cultural sense, medical sense, to have nurses who understood the traditions and the culture.
Yeah.
And, you know, these are things that we hope going forward we can attend to. She had hoped that there was a sanatorium built in Whitehorse because there was also a TB outbreak. Like, she doesn't just deal with diphtheria in the book, right?
Yeah.
There's diphtheria, there's measles, there's polio, there's TB, and everybody has to get flown out. So she was saying then, come on, come on, we need facilities in the North, we need nurses in the North, we need, and even today at the Whitehorse Hospital, and I might get this wrong, I was there this summer, they either have a respirator but no respiratory therapist, or they have a respiratory therapist but no respirator.
Mm.
And what are we dealing with now? Like, I look at the statistics coming in around COVID and I go, God help us.
Yeah.
That we don't have cases in the North because I don't think that the infrastructure is there. So now, still 60 years after Amy wrote this book, the Indigenous populations are still among our most vulnerable nationally, and it's a shame.
Yeah.
It's a shame.
What was it like growing up for you? I mean, this book was obviously around. I don't know if you read it as a kid, but, I mean, there must have been stories about her from your grandmother in the family lore, if you will.
Yes. Oh, there's so much in the family lore. Again, like I said, because it was quite a large family. Actually, my grandmother and Amy died the same year, which was a real blow to the family. Amy died of heart failure, and my grandmother of cancer, but so it was a double blow to the family, and I just grew up on the stories, and yes, I did read the book as a kid and then revisited it many times later. I've always been drawn back to it.
Yeah.
But you know, also in the family lore is her love of music, our family's love of music, and one of the lines that comes from a letter that Amy wrote home, with how she always traveled with instruments, even going up north for that that first outbreak of diphtheria. She shoved her accordion into the the airplane and, you know, traveled around with that. I have photographs of her with little indigenous children where she would have given them instruments. Like, she was asking the family to always send up harmonicas and little handheld instruments and so on that the kids could play with. And her line, and it's one I love, and it's also a valuable line today, is sometimes only music can heal you. And when days are long, at the end of those days, to be able to sit down and sing a little tune, play a little tune, come together and share music, it has maybe as much, sometimes maybe more, healing power than anything we have to offer. That's something that heals the soul as well. So that's the kind of lore, that's the kind of thing I was raised on, kind of thing that was just part of the family's, I guess, defining values.
I read somewhere, Laurel, that you're working on a biography.
I was working on a biography. I've put it on hold because I'm struggling with, again, my right or not right to, I'm R-I-G-H-T, to W-R-I-T-E, this biography where, you know, 90% of the other people involved in the story of Amy are Indigenous people. And how can I adequately, or is it my right to adequately even attempt to produce something? So what I may do in the future is actually do a compilation of her letters, her poetry, her essays and illustrations. So I don't actually have a word in it at all, but just compile all of this material into something. So I don't know what that's even called, because it's more of a collection or an anthology than it is a biography. So I don't know. I don't know what is left. I mean, there's a lot left that could be done with the Amy Wilson story. What I would like to add, I don't know how we're doing on time, but this is something very near and dear to my heart. And here's the thing. This book came out in 1965, so it's in the public domain. So when I went to Caitlin Press and sort of, you know, pitched this story, I said, you know, Amy's dead, so she wouldn't have any rights to the royalty, nor would her family. It's not a new book. I don't have rights to any kind of royalty payment. And so Caitlin Press and I put our heads together, and what we've done is made it so that the royalties from the sale of this book, and that's where I become a real shameless hussy, go to an organization called CINA, the Canadian Indigenous Nurses Association, because they have a scholarship for Canadian Indigenous nurses training. So revenue off of this book is not going into anybody's hands other than where it should go in honoring Amy to Indigenous nurses training. So, that's the real, also near and dear to my heart aspect about bringing this book out, for all the other reasons that we've just been talking about.
Sure, sure.
But also that moving forward, knowing what her heart's desire was around the needs of Northern people, that this is maybe one way that we can help, one way that we can function in the spirit of reconciliation, just this tiny gesture of at least, it's the least we can do is give the proceeds from this book to an organization that's bringing more Indigenous nurses into the community.
And I can't help but think that that's what she would have wanted.
It's what she would have wanted. Oh, absolutely. I think if she could have done it then, I think that it's the kind of thing that she would naturally have come to herself mm-hmm. had she lived. And had she known how successful the book was going to be, nobody could have predicted that it was going to sell like it did.
Right.
And it wouldn't have surprised me, but I'm only speculating, or maybe it's wishful thinking, but I would imagine that she would have gone, oh, I don't need these royalties.
Yeah.
Let's do something with them.
Yeah.
But just the same way, you know, all of the siblings in that Wilson family helped educate the next kid coming up. She would have gone, okay, well, you know, how do I move this money forward to make it really useful, really valuable? And I suspect that she would have certainly. Oh, I like to think that she's somewhere and seeing how her legacy lives on and how this, goes the help goes where it ought to.
Yeah.
But, you know, money doesn't need to be held in one's hand. It needs to be shared, and it's like scattering a bunch of seeds.
Yeah.
And I don't think that was very articulate.
Or at the very least, that her story, her writing, I mean, resonates still 60 years later. I mean, I can't think of a better legacy as well.
Yeah. Well, and doesn't that speak to just simple language, a story well told,
yeah.
and told from the heart?
Yeah.
I think that's the real key. She doesn't sugarcoat anything. She doesn't. She's just, straight from heart to heart. And this is the kind of connections we need to be making, always.
Now more than ever.
Now more than ever.
Yeah. Laurel, it's so nice to talk again. I appreciate your time, and most of all, I appreciate you and your efforts to get this book out again and urge people listening to us to pick it up, because it's a great story, and it'll help people and more ways than one now, certainly.
Yes, it will. And, you know, this is the other weird thing, Joe. It's hard to pick up a book now, right, because stores are closing.
Sure.
But it's certainly available through Amazon and through Caitlin Press directly.
Yeah, I know if people listening in Vancouver, there are a number of independent bookstores that are doing deliveries, so they can get it that way.
Yes, they can. I think the Book Warehouse is delivering from Vancouver.
Yeah.
I don't know about the others, but
yes,
it can certainly be purchased. And like I said, every purchase is going to spread a little seed in Indigenous education and also just maybe light up our world a little bit now, because it's a tough time right now.
Thanks for this, Laurel.
Joseph, thank you so much for the opportunity.
For more information, visit ldmbooks.ca. The book is called When Days Are Long, Nurse in the North. It is published by Caitlin Press. Laurel Diedrich Main, the grandniece of Amy Wilson, joined me on the line from Edmonton, Alberta. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plunta.